Hello and welcome to Two Fat Expats, where we're all about packing as much into your expat life as you can. And that's what we mean when we say fat. We mean full and overflowing. This expat podcast is listened to in over 160 countries, and we have a Facebook group with nearly 13,000 members. I'm Kirsty Rice. I'm an Aussie based here in Qatar, and each week I'm joined by Nikki Moffat, who's also an Aussie, and she's in Hamburg, Germany. Say hi, Nikki.
Hello.
Together we have 12 locations between us, which is a lot of not knowing which time zone you're in and standing at the baggage carousel with a broken stroller and two toddlers to carry. How are you, Nikki Moffat?
I'm all good, Kirsty Rice. Thank you. How are you? What did you get for Christmas? How was your birthday? What's going on with all your children? I have so many questions. And Happy New Year.
Thank you. Happy New Year to you too. Oh my God. You know, Christmas feels, it's only January. Christmas feels about a gazillion miles ago. Does that doesn't even make sense, that sentence, does it? It does feel like a long time ago. I got actually one of the most interesting and slightly controversial presents I did get for Christmas was, you know, amongst the usual books and, you know, treats and clothing and, you know, with Australia, a lot of beach stuff, etc. My husband then came out after all was done and said, I've got one more thing. And out came this polystyrene box, and in it was a lot of ice and a crayfish.
On Christmas morning?
Yes. Now, here's the reason why he thought that was a great thing, was because I love, you know, lobsters and crayfish and whatever. And obviously it's way too expensive to feed a family of six, and then way, way too expensive when you're feeding a family of, you know, 20 extras and whatever for lunch. And so I think he thought, oh, this will be really special. You know, I'll get her a crayfish. And it was there sort of cut in half and whatever. But of course, then you have the controversial, that's my crayfish. Am I sharing? Yeah. And how do I share? And everyone's looking at my crayfish, and it's really no longer my present anymore, is it? Oh, dear. So, that was probably one of the more interesting presents to get, was a crayfish and a box of ice.
So next year, G should give you the crayfish, but with instructions. So no one else is allowed to have this crayfish. This is only for Kirsty.
What did you get for Christmas, Nikki Moffat?
What did I get for Christmas? Well, our family went deep into wireless earbuds, AirPods, things that you can't see. So now, instead of walking around the house with things and people can see when you're not listening, people can't tell when I'm not listening because they can't see the things in my ears. So that's where we went on Christmas.
Yes, yes, yes.
It's all about listening.
We've gone down that path as well. Now, Nikki, we're going to kick off today in our usual format, following the plan. We'll break up the podcast into five topics, which are, of course,
geographically challenged, which is where we talk about the impact of having lived in more than one place. We'll also cover expat relationships, and that can be anyone you've met or any place you've been in your expat travels.
We'll also look at expat tech, where we look at the latest tech available to expats, and expat money, where today, drum roll, we talk to Mr. X.
Very, very exciting. And after that, we'll be going to location, where we speak to an expat living somewhere in the world and ask them the Fat Five questions.
All right, so let's get started with geographically challenged. Look, Nikki, I'd love to hear a little bit more about your personal project. And the reason I say this, and it's not really your personal project, although I do have a sneaking suspicion it may have become a bit of your personal project by the sounds of things. But I was actually going to put this down in my, you know, what we've been listening to and what we'd recommend and what we liked. And I'm not sure how much you're sharing this with the world. So I will kick off this conversation. You can stop me at any time. So your beautiful boy did a personal project for his MYP. He's in year 10 doing the IB program at an international school in Hamburg.
Yep.
And he chose to do an audio book, and he chose to talk about some of the, I don't know, what would you call it, Nikki?
Well, I'd call it the world through his eyes. but he structured it in a way that he broke it down into, but yeah, basically it's the world as how he sees it as a teenager living an international life on the autism spectrum. That's how he looks at it. Yeah.
Yeah. And I haven't told you this yet, but I actually downloaded it onto my phone, and then I went for a little walk around the compound for an hour sort of to have a listen. So I had your man in my ears while I wandered around the compound listening. Now, the tricky thing about the personal project is it's not really the content that they're after. It's more about how the learning process of making the content. But I have to say that was fantastic content. And I'm not sure, I'm really probably putting you on the spot here, whether you're willing to share his project with the world or how he feels about that. But I thoroughly enjoyed it. Like, I just thought it was such a great piece of content. It was, for a start, he has a stunning voice. He sounds very much like my eldest son, actually. It's that beautiful, my voice is broken, but I'm still not a man yet, but I've got this beautiful tone in my voice. And that soft kind of intercontinental accent where it does probably sound, I think, to the untrained ear, he probably sounds American, but I think to the rest of us, you can see, oh, no, there's hints of this. Oh, no, there's hints of that. And he just spoke so beautifully about what it's been like to travel when being on the spectrum, and how, and it wasn't a woe is me story, and it wasn't, horror story. It was really comical at times when he was more on the, well, I just don't get it. Do you know why you people feel this way? I just don't understand. But, and also, Nikki, I thought very bravely, you know, he spoke very honestly about you and your husband and what that's like for him, and people's expectations and what people quite often expect of people on the spectrum. I just thought it was beautifully done.
Well, I did too, and I'm very proud of him, obviously. I encouraged him to do a podcast or / audiobook because I know it's something he likes to talk about, it as in his experiences. He's become a little bit of a self-advocate. He did a speech to his grade last year about what it's like to have autism when they were studying the serious incident, the dog in the nighttime. So he talked to the whole grade about that. So I think that I obviously encouraged him on the personal project front, and I encouraged him with the audio, and I taught him how to record and how to edit, but I didn't, the content is totally all his. I really love reading his writing. I think he's quite a good writer. And look, I just know that his essay won't be anywhere near as good as that, his reflections on the process. So I'm just going to rest on the laurels of his actual content, his product. But look, he has shared it on SoundCloud. One of his goals for his project was to self-publish, so it is there in the public domain for anyone to listen to. At his personal project presentation day, he had a link that people could access. He obviously had the book there, but it's a bit long for someone to stand at a little desk and listen to. So he has been sharing it, and people have been sharing it. So I don't have any issue with sharing it in the show notes, because I think everyone should listen to it. And also, so in case anyone's interested, it's like a career in voice work. So if anyone's got any contacts, I'm now a parent agent. No, I'm kidding. I'm not kidding about being what he wants to do, but I'm kidding about being a parent agent.
You know, it's interesting when we're talking about the reflection. You know, my kids have been at international schools pretty much through the whole thing. But what has really struck me in the last 10 years is how much bloody reflection is required on everything. Do you know, every little thing they do seems to involve a reflection sheet. So, you know, they're always reflecting on what they've learned and reflecting on if they've, you know, come across a problem at school and reflecting on if they've behaved badly. And, you know, I want you to write me a reflection on, you know, how you felt about the bloody softball tournament. Like, it's just incredible how reflective our children are being trained to be. I cannot remember nearly as much reflection as a child.
No, and I also don't find it reflected in their personalities. I don't find them reflective on decisions they've made or things like that, because maybe they're just so sick of writing about their reflections about the other things they've done. Or do you have a different take on that? Do you think your children are more reflective than you perhaps were at that age?
No, I don't. I think they're children, and that's the whole thing about being a child is that you don't really reflect on your actions at all. I think the fight is futile to try and think that they will. Oh, look, I think what it does, what I live in fear that it does, is I think there's a possibility that at that age maybe you don't have the maturity to really deeply reflect. And so if you are immature and you're learning just to say what you think needs to be said, that kind of worries me.
Yeah, look, I agree. I'm sure that there's an IB teacher out there somewhere that's yelling while they're listening to this, saying, this is the reason that we teach them to do all the reflection. And maybe there is, like, we should look into that. So if someone wants to dial that in and go to www.twofedexpats.com and tell us why all the reflection, we're very open to it. Because if it means that, you know, in 5 or 10 years it'll all click and they'll be like the best leaders and thought leaders and thinkers, then I'm all for that.
Absolutely.
I'm just not looking forward to the next 2 weeks around a 3,500-word essay on the reflections on the project.
And just talking about schools and kids and whatever, I thought a little update, Nikki, with expat relationships is those who have been regular listeners to the podcast would have heard my eldest daughter head off to boarding school and then us talk about the fact that she was also doing IB and that she's just got through her final year of IB and she's just got her results and hooray, hooray, she's just got her first preference into university. Hooray. And just because I know that there were a lot of people when I was talking about IB, we had a lot of people voice their concerns or, you know, lack of understanding or, you know, wanting to learn more about IB and whether they thought it was the right thing for their kids. It's interesting. My daughter and I have different feelings on this. She did the IB, so you should take her point of view way above mine, I imagine. She says she would definitely do it again and that she thought it was a great thing to do and she feels that it was a success and you would have to say she got her first preference. She's going to do a double degree in international relations and economics, so she's set now, she's in. And so I cannot tell you as a parent, Nikki, the relief of that feeling. It's far, you know, getting the results, you're like, oh, good, but you still don't know, do you know, really what that means. Actually getting the acceptance to university is the most incredible feeling as a parent of, yes, we made it, do you know, like we're there, we got there. And I guess my personal take on the IB just quickly was that, no, I think it would have been a far easier road for her had she done the Everyday Australian, you know, year 12. And I think she could have still done the Everyday Australian year 12 and got into universities all over the world because they do take those results. But she would have learnt differently, I guess, and that's her take, is that she loves the way that the IB teaches you about the world, that it's truly international. And she likes that style.
I'll be very interested to hear her reflections on her first year at university, in that how she copes with the university style learning compared to all her peers who've been through
totally
a different system.
And I hear that, Nikki, because I think that's what you get sold on in Australia, is they say, yes, but if she does the IB, she has a much stronger chance of, you know, getting through university and doing better at university. So I think, yes, you have to keep that into account. But I still do know many, many, many children that didn't do IB and flew through university and have gone on to have great careers. So I don't know if you'll ever know.
Yeah, but I just think how she feels about it, how she feels about coping, because that's all. I mean, I don't doubt that all the children will that go into the course, there's an equal dropout rate and there's an equal change in courses and there's an equal everything. But just how she feels about approaching exams and all that kind of stuff, whether it's a different, whether she feels more comfortable compared to her friends based on her own peer assessment.
Yes, that's very true.
Then, you know,
other people. And look, it's different across the world, but I know – yeah, and we've talked about this before, so I won't go on for too long, but you're right. Like, you would think university learning involves a lot more exams, and year 12 now you can do five subjects and only have one exam or none. So, you know, Lizzie has friends that had two. And obviously that your results then are far more assessment wise. And that was one of her things. She said she'd much rather do exams than do assessments. I don't know.
Me too, Lizzie. I'm with her.
The great thing is it's done. And I'm just so glad it's done. I now get a break of a year before the next child goes into year 12, and then the next child will go into year 12 after that. So, we'll just enjoy this year and then crack on with it. All right, Nikki, moving right along. Expat relationships. We were going to talk this week about the relationship between the UAE and Qatar. And I know this would mean nothing to you if you are an expat in Hong Kong or Singapore or even in Houston or Myanmar, but it is becoming a bigger and bigger deal here with Doha and, you know, pull out a UAE country, let's say Dubai.
Yeah, I think that basically when it all happened initially, we heard about it, we talked about it briefly, and then for the rest of the world, it kind of went away. But you guys there are living it every day, really. And we've tried to talk to a couple of people about sort of different situations they have, and people feel very reticent speaking openly about it, even anonymously. So it's interesting that it has that much impact. So we'd love to hear Kirsty.
So I guess probably the things that we thought were going to be a problem were not, in that we thought food would be an issue, in that we got so much food from Saudi, but that was all fixed very quickly, in that we now get a lot of food from Turkey and Iran and from Europe. Do you know, it comes across in huge big cargo planes and ships and whatever. So really, and now there is a lot more food made in Doha. So in one way, you know, we now have our own dairies and we have our own eggs and we have a lot more things that you can see made here.
New industries.
Yeah, whole new industries. And I know with the dairy, you know, they flew in cows from Australia and from the USA, and they've started dairies. And so in that side of things.
Sorry, can I just ask, are these like massive buildings with air conditioning? Or do the cows stand outside?
I haven't been to the dairy, but my husband and children have been to the dairy. That was one of the things I missed. Grandma came to town when I was out of town, and Grandma got to go to the dairy because Grandma's from the farm. So, you know, Grandma will be totally into this. And, yeah, they did. They went to the dairy. Huge, air-conditioned, lovely, luxurious accommodation for the Aussie cows, who are probably wondering what in the hell happened. So for that side of things, you know, we're fine. You really would not notice, you know, there's no, you know, remember when it first happened, Nikki, there were all those pictures of supermarket shelves that were, you know, barren, and everybody thought we were going to be sort of locked in, and none of that has happened. And, you know, there was also the flying out and having to fly around Dubai, you know, so you didn't fly over the top of it and all that sort of thing. So we thought, you know, well, maybe our air travel is going to be extended. Well, in some instances it actually got shorter because they found alternative routes and did deals and whatever. So that hasn't been a problem. But what has been interesting, and I think an example to give that people might see from this podcast, is, you know, those who will remember the lovely Sarah, who was originally on the podcast with me, her and I arranged to have a chat about her new life in Dubai, and I was going to do like a little catch-up episode of, you know, what's Sarah up to now and how's it all going. And Sarah sort of said, you know, she didn't really feel all that comfortable about doing that now that she was in Dubai, because if you are in Dubai at the moment, you are very clearly told that you are not to travel to Qatar and you are not to deal with Qatar. Do you know that there is an embargo and you're not to get involved? So people are very conscious of using their phones and who they're talking to on their phones and things being tracked and that sort of thing. And we also had, as you alluded to, Nikki, we have a listener who works in Dubai but lives in Qatar, and she really wasn't comfortable in talking to us at all about it, because I'm not sure if people realize now when you fly out of Doha, you cannot fly to Dubai. So or directly, you know, there are no flights going back and forth. There used to be roughly, I think, something like 10 flights a day just with one particular airline here. That doesn't happen anymore. And so people now fly to Kuwait and then do Kuwait to Dubai, you know, to get in, or they go, you know, to Oman and do it that way. So I think it's very interesting that people are being very careful about speaking to Qatar.
Yeah, and there's no, like, there's no ability to contact, right? So you can't use Skype or there's no sort of interaction that way as well.
So, you know, someone like me who works online constantly, I came back and there was no longer any WhatsApp, no Skype, no FaceTime. So if people were planning on using those things, they would have to, you know, get a VPN and do that. And, you know, if you use a sort of a government telecom modem, you can't put a VPN on those things, do you know? So communication has definitely been affected.
Yeah, that's really interesting. And I think it's just, I think it's great that we can talk about that, because you're living and experiencing that. And these things happen in so many different parts of the world. But when you're looking always at a Western mainstream news perspective, it kind of gets overtaken by a lot of other stuff that's really a little bit superfluous, but is grabbing the headlines of the day, whereas this is sort of like an ongoing thing that's really, you know, a little bit more serious and substantial. So
no, that's
thanks for
fine.
The update.
And I will put in a link, because there's a great link, because all of this sort of happened, you know, when the Saudis decided that they weren't talking to the Qataris anymore. Look, there's a really, really interesting article in the New York Times. I'll put a link to it if people want to look at the reasons of why this has all come about and a few theories, because it is a much broader tale where we're talking about an American involvement as well, and all sorts of things. And so I'll make sure I include that article. So if there's others that want to know sort of how this all started and what happened, it's, interesting times.
Okay, Nikki Moffat, we're up to expat tech, but I probably should add right now that a few seconds ago in this podcast, I was talking to you in Doha, and I was up in my bedroom in Qatar, and we were having a chat, and then we kind of ran out of a bit of time because I had to go on the school run, and then I had to leave the country. So I am now talking to you from Australia. Now, we didn't have to tell everyone that. We could have tried to wing it and just pretend that we were, you know, just cruising right along. But I did think, as expats, it added to what's really going on here and the reality of our situation.
Yeah, it's the reality of our lives. Well, more your life than mine. But yes, I think it does need to be addressed, because it's something that happens. So now, in case you notice a change in anything, Kirsty's now in an environment where the sound in the birds, in the culture prayer, but there's weird birds. Yeah, so Kirsty's in Australia. So, but Kirsty, tell me, what is, I think your technically expat item can help in Australia or in Qatar?
Okay, so I got an Apple Watch for my birthday, which is New Year's Eve. So I got it just after Christmas. And my Apple Watch has changed my life in the fact that I now no longer sit down for any more than 45 minutes at a time because my Apple Watch says, get up and move. You've sat down for too long. But I am absolutely loving it. But one of the things I do love in my little expat world of my Apple Watch is the fact that I can keep the two time zones on my screen of my Apple Watch at all times. So I know what time it is in Doha right now. I can tell you that it's 11:15 in the morning, but I can also see that it's 6:45 in the evening here in Adelaide. Now, that might just be a small thing, but it's something that really works for me when I have, you know, half my children in one country and half in the other. The activity tracker, I think, is fantastic because I'm now not fumbling around on the treadmill, you know, trying to make sure that I do exactly the right amount of, you know, kilometers and whatever. I'm just on the move all the time. And it's waterproof, so I can keep it on my hand at all times. I don't take it off when I do the dishes. I wear it when I'm on my paddleboard. I absolutely love it. So if there's anyone who's been thinking about the Apple Watch, I would highly recommend it. Now, Nikki, you are not an Apple person, so I imagine it's maybe not on your radar.
It's not, but I know that people that have it love it, and I've admired many a new Apple Watch wristband since Christmas when people were given different bands for their Christmas gifts. Yeah, so I've admired many new Apple Watch wristbands.
I have a very ugly
wristband.
There
are some very cool ones.
Yeah, I need to think about a cool one. Okay, Nikki, we're moving on to expat money, which, of course, the big thing is we're going to hear from Mr. X. But just before we go there, I had promised that I would answer a question about that sneaky little thing that comes up when you travel and when you're possibly at the airport or you're in a hotel and you hand over your credit card and the waitress asks you, do you want to pay in Aussie or US? Or do you want to pay in reals or in dollars? Or basically, do you want me to convert this currency to your home country currency? Or do you want to pay, you know, where you're traveling in the country? I think I've probably really bamboozled that up, but I hope that makes sense. And people were saying, you know, what do you say? Do you answer that you should be, you know, using the currency of the country that you're in? Or should you be converting to the country of your credit card? And someone was saying, what do you do? Now, I have found out exactly what you do. What this term is called DCC, and it's dynamic currency conversion. And so if you're sitting there going, what you should do, you should always stay in the country of that you're in. You should not ask them to convert.
Yay.
Yes.
That's what I've been doing. I've been doing it right.
Now, the reason you buy in the currency you're in is because if you don't, that merchant, so that hotel or that airport or whatever, that restaurant, they will be slugging you the conversion fee, and it's anywhere up to 4% and sometimes even more. So no, don't convert. Just say no, I'll pay in your currency, and it'll all happen behind the scenes for much less.
So if you choose local currency, it's all done on the spot through the system by the companies and using exchange rates. Whereas if you choose your home currency, they have the time to go and do the magical things with the money, and that might end up costing you more.
Yes, that's the answer.
Is that right?
Okay. So let's move on to Mr. X.
Welcome, Mr. X, to Two Fat Expats.
Thank you very much.
Now, tell me, Mr. X, how long have you been an expat yourself?
Right. I moved to Singapore in 1999, and it's been a great ride of being an expat, and I really enjoy it. And I was in Singapore for 9 years, Hong Kong for 3 years, and I've been in the Middle East now for 8 years now. Yeah.
Wow. And do you think this expat gig, you know, it's like some people say it's a short-term thing. Do you think now you're in it for the long haul?
I think I might be. Yes, we all say that. Well, a lot of us say that. Oh, we're only going to be for a couple of years, and it extends and extends. And never thought I'd be in the Middle East for this amount of time. I have a young family, and there's obviously those sorts of concerns of whether they're going to have schooling here in the Middle East, which fantastic schools, obviously, as well.
Yeah.
Maybe is it the age of at the start of school life, or is it at high school that you want to move back and and give them a taste of life back home? Or,
yeah. And who knows? Because we all start with those small children saying, "Well, by the time they're this age, we're going to do this, and by the time they're this age, we're going to do that." And best laid plans. So, tell me, Mr. X, you've worked in sort of the financial industry for the past sort of 20 years. Have you always worked with expats in that time?
Yes, I have. Yes. I have worked always in regulated financial advice. That's my background. I'm licensed and regulated in Singapore and Hong Kong and the country in the Middle East that I've been now. Always worked with expats and dealing with their specific needs.
Yes, yes.
And there are so many more needs that expats have than you would back home.
Yeah.
So we can talk about those in the coming weeks, and I'm really excited to be able to help your podcast listeners with their financial questions and things I want to talk about.
Fantastic. And I will remind people now while they're listening that if you have a question for Mr. X, if you've got a specific expat financial question, please head over to our website, twofatexpats.com, and you'll see there's a little microphone on the right-hand side. You click on the microphone and you can ask your question there, and Mr. X will answer it for you next week or in the coming weeks. Mr. X, I think you've just hit the nail on the head with the fact that expat financial matters are slightly different to at home. For instance, I work for the Barefoot Investor, and he's written two fantastic books that give great, common sense advice to people. But there's a few things in there where I think this just would not work for an expat, like don't have a credit card. I cannot imagine traveling without knowing that I had a credit card in case of a massive emergency. Can you tell me, Mr. X, what do you think some of the most common mistakes are that expats make with their money?
That's a great question. It's such a broad question, isn't it? Because there are so many mistakes that you could make, and we can go very detailed or very broad. And I think today I'll just keep it at a high level and give you a couple of major things that people can look out for.
Fantastic.
And then in the coming weeks, let's delve into those each week and talk about them in detail.
Brilliant.
All right, great. Well, one of the first really easy ones, the mistakes that people make is really not just to gloss over real quickly, is to not inform your country, your home country, that you're actually an expat. That you're non-resident. Some people think that when they leave their home country that they don't need to file a tax return anymore, and that's it.
Yep.
Make sure that you do that and say that you've been in the country for less than the required amount of days. It differs across all different countries. And whether you're tax resident for 183 days out of the year, or is it 90 days you're resident? So get some advice, firstly, in your first year that you are an expat from your accountant back home, and say that, okay, I've left either halfway through the year or at the start of the year, and make sure you file that return and let them know that you're no longer there and you will be paying, hopefully, less tax.
Oh, God, that is such good advice. And I'll tell you why, because even I think as a long-term expat, I've been an expat for 20 years, and we did that correctly at the start. Like, we did have the accountant and we, lodged the tax return and said all of that. But then, of course, we got older and our accountant got older and he died. And so we kind of moved on. But what happened was I wasn't lodging the tax return. My husband was, but I kind of got lost in the mix. And yeah, it was one of those things like between countries and moving and things and, you know, that whole thing of thinking that everything's covered and under control. And we kind of lost it for a couple of years. So I think that's really, it sounds so simple,
yeah,
but
right.
You can kind of get rolling. And I think too, the further detached you get from your country of origin, the more likely these things pop up. No, that's great advice. So great. What else have you got for us, Mr. X?
Okay. Well, the next one really is simply not setting up your buckets. And I just call them buckets. And what that means is not properly planning and setting up what buckets of money that you need for various things that happen in your life. So You're going to retire, your kids might go to university and pay before fee paying students. You might be wanting to buy a house or another house, and all of these goals, and it's part of the wider concept of really goal setting. So
yes.
It's sitting down and really working out with your significant other, or if you're a single person, it's just yourself, but you might want to get some help from, you know, your mum and dad or people that are more experienced in financial matters than you perhaps. But certainly if you've got a partner to sit down with them, and communication is so important here. You often hear of one partner leaving it to the other to deal with finances, and that never goes very well.
No.
Yeah. I've seen it all. If you do leave the finances to your partner, fantastic, as long as you've got the overall goal setting in place, and there's a bit of a review system there to make sure that you're on track, you know, with your goals, and there's no surprises.
Yes,
that's really the second thing, setting up the buckets, and I'll talk about what that means, you know, in the future.
Yes.
And how to do that and what you should be doing as part of the larger concept of really setting the right goals.
Yeah. And Mr. X, would you say that people maybe lose sight of that because, you know, a lot of times people put expats kind of in the same bracket as like a professional sports person, you know, that they've got an opportunity and they've got a certain amount of time to make the most of that opportunity. And also at the same time, they're in danger of getting swept up with what others around them are doing. So
yes.
So maybe they're living like a bit of a rock star because that's what it looks like that everybody else is doing, whether that's, you know, long brunches on Fridays and lots of, you know, exotic travel elsewhere, because you think, well, how are those people doing it over there? You know, I've got to do that too. But also maybe people think they've got a lot more money than they are because they are under this illusion that expats are, you know, living this tax-free, you know, gold mine of an existence, in the same way that, you know, sometimes that happens with young sports people as well. So do you think perhaps people stop with that, you know, remembering about their buckets and whatever, because they are influenced by what's going around them? What do you see expats doing financially in that regard?
Absolutely. That's such a key point, that people see that they want to keep up with the Joneses, and they forget that maybe the Joneses next door already have their financial plans in place. You don't know.
Yeah.
So they can go out to brunches everywhere, can go on holidays everywhere. But simple old you know, you've got to really take care of yourself. And the concept that I really stress with my clients is to pay yourself first.
Right.
Before you do all of the paying for everything else and setting up your budget and paying all the things we need to pay and spend and set a budget on, yourself is really the most important. And the first top line of your budget shouldn't be your rent. It should be how much, you know, given that these are my goals, how much should I be putting away for myself for my future? Because this is why I'm here in the first place.
Right.
So once that's done, then you can work out, okay, the type of lifestyle you want to live and the type of, usually most expats are renting, so the rent amount and then how much they're going to allocate for living expenses and school fees, et cetera, et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
But that should really be at the end. Most people that I've seen actually who come to me, they do it the other way around. They have all their spending, and then whatever's left over, that's for them. And that's certainly not the way you should be doing it.
Right. Oh, I can't wait to talk to you about that more when we like sort of look into expat budgets and things like that. So what are some of the other mistakes? Is there anything else you want to add? Sort of, I know we're painting with a broad brush today, but anything else?
Yeah, I mean, we will get around to all this, but just really briefly, once you've got all your goals in place, then it's all about how you get there. And for that, usually a lot of people do need some advice, and it's just hard to know who to trust, isn't it?
Mm.
So that financial advisor piece is really important, of making sure that you got a good financial advisor who works for your best interests. Mm. And I'll talk in the future about what questions you need to ask your financial advisor and what kind of research you need to do on them and the things you need to have for them to have in place so that you can know that you're getting advice that's certainly in your best interest and that's going to, you know, give you a good return in the future.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because I think most expats would say that, you know, it is terrifying trying to find good financial advice as an expat, because there have been people in the past, like you say, sharks, and I'm definitely not looking in your direction, Mr. X, because I know that I can trust you and I know you personally. Indeed. And I know people who use you and trust you. But I think there is nothing worse than like going to the expat function where you've put down your name and number and getting that dodgy phone call, you know, a couple of days later where you find out your details have been passed on to some, you know, company who's completely fleeced your private details, and you know they want to have a cup of coffee with you to talk about, you know, what they can do with your money. And it's a really frightening exercise in that you just don't know who you can trust. So I would love to talk about that more, about how you do find someone, like how do you know when people are accredited, and you know, like what happens to those people? Is there someone watching over those people? And I guess in Australia we'd have like an Australian authority that would look. How does that work internationally? So, but anyway, we can talk about that as the weeks go on. One last tip about a common mistake.
One last tip, okay. And these, actually, I've sort of got two, but they're in the same breath, really, because it's all about kind of what happens if things go wrong. So it really is that most expats that I've found, and the research is there to back my thinking up, is that most expats are underinsured, really don't have the right amount of life insurance, if they have any at all, and don't have the right amount of, say, critical illness insurance that they might need should something go wrong. We'll talk about that. So how much insurance is enough? And I'll talk about, you know, what kinds of insurance are there and what suits me best. I can't give obviously any specific advice to people, but I'm talking generally about what's out there and how you can approach the insurance market and try to reduce people's fears and risks of approaching that topic. Yeah.
Yes.
And the last one was also wills. Was not writing a will and not having a will in place, just in case something goes wrong as well. So, we can talk about the kinds of wills there are and how you best go about that too. So that's something that we can talk about in the future too. What do you think about that?
Oh, I love it. I love it. I love it. This is exactly what I wanted to do. This is brilliant. All right, Mr. Great. X, well, we will come back next week. We've had a lot of questions come in from our listeners, from why don't I have any money? how can you help me do that?
You're not paying yourself first. Spoiler alert.
And I did love the, do expats still have tax havens, or was that just something that happened in the 70s? And don't spoil that one for me, because I'm busting to find out. But okay, we will come back to talk to you again next week. In the meantime, please, people, phone in with your questions at twofatexpats.com. Just click on the microphone and you can leave Mr. X your own personal finance question. Thank you, Mr. X. We'll talk to you next week.
Thanks, Kirsty. Great to be here and talk to you next week.
You know, Kirsty.
Yes.
I think I might have met Mr. X in Hong Kong.
Well, I can never, ever tell you if that's true because Mr. X cannot show his face or tell his name. Yes, and if people are wondering why can't we know who Mr. X is, it's because we are fiercely independent in this podcast and we do not want to show our alliances in any way to any particular company. And so we want this to be legitimately independent where we're not flogging any particular product. So we're just looking for really good independent financial advice. So Mr. X has very kindly agreed that he will not mention the products or the companies that he would recommend. But of course, if people are desperate to get hold of Mr. X, we can't stop you in any way. And we're more than happy to pass on his details. But on this podcast, we're staying fiercely independent.
Yeah, which is great. And I love that. And I also love all the things Mr. X is going to be talking about.
I know. So he's fantastic.
Good times ahead.
I do think Mr. X and I might have been a little nervy there at the beginning. So give us a couple of weeks and I'm sure we'll warm up and get rolling. But yeah, I'm really, really excited about what he's going to be able to talk to us about week by week and what we're going to learn. All right, Nikki, location, location, location. Who did you speak to this week?
Well, Kirsty, we're up to S this week, and S is, of course, we could not do S without doing Singapore, and you couldn't do Singapore without speaking to Kelly, who literally wrote the book on Singapore.
She did. She did. She wrote the Culture Shock book, didn't she?
She absolutely did, and I hadn't heard of Culture Shock books at all before Kelly wrote hers, and I ended up buying the Culture Shock Germany book after I got here because I thought maybe I need that. Okay. So let's have a listen, shall we? On a scale of 1 to 10, what's your current level of in love with Singapore?
Well, that's a really interesting question because we're going home for the annual trip next week. And so this is very much the low point of my yearly affection for Singapore. I'm at the point where I do need to go back to Australia for a bit. So I would probably say today, it's probably a 6 or a 7. Only because I'm tired.
So I was going to say, is that up or down on 12 months ago? But it's about the same this time every year.
This time every year, yeah, I find, and it's like when you work and you're getting ready for holidays, that's how I find this time before we go home to Australia, where you just want it to end and you just want to have your holiday and be home. So, yeah, everything's exhausting me here at the moment. But I also know it's not because of Singapore, it's just because of where we are in the year. The school year's ending. We're about to have 5 weeks break. So little things are getting under my skin that normally wouldn't.
Kelly, you wrote the book on Singapore, actually literally wrote a book about Singapore. So the next question I'm going to ask you might find a little bit hard to answer, but what's your best local find?
Oh, my best local find. My absolute favourite thing in Singapore is the Hindu festival of Thai Pisam, which is a Tamil Hindu festival where they pierce themselves. Yeah. And I just love that. I don't know why. It sounds macabre, but it's not in any way. It's a very inclusive and happy festival. And to me, every year that I go, I think, wow, I really am in a different country. It's just so far out of anything you would see in Australia.
So what time of year does that happen?
It usually happens in January-ish. It's something to do with the moons.
Okay.
Next year it's January 21.
And you'll be back from Australia by then?
We will, yes. Yeah. And I always make time to go. And I have someone I know who I've watched get ready, his uncle gets ready. I've watched him for many years, so I try and catch him and watch his family prepare for the procession.
Okay. So what about Singapore drives you crazy?
Oh, what about Singapore drives me crazy? I was thinking this morning when I was out at the shops. Slow walkers. And you've lived in Asia, so you would understand the snorting, sniffling.
Yes, yes, yes. Throat clearing.
The throat clearing. That whole, you know, in Western countries, you tend to not do that in public.
Yeah.
Yeah, they're the little things. They're the probably two little things that really do irritate me more than anything.
What's one place you'd love to live?
Oh, probably London, because I never did the gap year thing.
And you've been there twice this year for holidays, right?
So I have been twice this year, yeah. After a 20-year break, I thought I'd go twice in a few months.
So you really do know that you'd like to live there because you've spent time there.
Well, look, I think the weather would drive me insane, but you live in a very similar climate,
No comment.
Well, maybe I need to visit in February and review that thought.
What's the best piece of advice you've ever been given about your expat life?
The best piece of advice was given, I think, and it's one that I am very bad at doing, by the family that we replaced. They'd been here 7 years, and Rebecca said to me that you always need to make new friends. She said, we're on about our third cycle of good friends. Mm. So never close yourself off to making new friends, that you'll constantly need to make new friends.
Yeah, you find that in high rotation expat environments, also where there's a lot of expat.
Yeah.
There's a 2 and 3 year cycle, and then you kind of, so now you're 7 years in, are you in the I'm not open for new friends because it's too hard mode?
Yes. Yes. And I'm down to one or two really good friends. I had a farewell last night from my book club. So I started the book club 4 years ago, I think. And I'm the only original person left. There was 12 of us. And so over 4 years, one in 12 is left in that book club. And wow. I think that says a lot about expat, and particularly here where it is often high turnover, it's 2 or 3 years. Yeah, so the advice would be to keep making friends, and it's something that I struggle with. I'm not great at it.
What's the biggest lesson that you've learnt?
Oh, wow. The biggest lesson from being an expat, to just have a go, I guess, you know. Anything sounds scary, but just to try and do and see as much as you can. Yeah.
And you've also carved out a niche, so you're one of the magical people that's that has a job that is global, has totally mobile, right?
Yeah.
So how did you get into that? How did you find that? How did you decide that's what you wanted to do?
My main job is, I have written a book, but that's not my main job. My main job now is as a university marker and tutor, which was not something I pursued. I was asked by a friend whether I was interested in working for her as one of her markers. And that has then over 4 years developed, you know, into a bigger role over time. So it wasn't something that I pursued. It was something I was asked to do. I was very fortunate, and it's all online, so it works in perfectly with this sort of lifestyle.
And one thing that we ask our interviewees now is that if you have a book or a TV show, movie, podcast that you've recently reading, watched, listened to, that you'd recommend. Do you have anything to recommend?
Oh, I should have prepared for this one. A TV show I watched was a BBC one, BBC/ABC, Australian ABC, called The Cry. 4-part series. It has Asha Keddie, Alex Dimitriadis, and the actress who plays Queen Victoria in Victoria. I think that's the show.
Uh-huh.
Gemma someone, I think her name is. And it's about something happens to their baby. They go to Australia for a trip and something happens to the baby. Gripping. Absolutely great 4-part series.
Okay, so Kirsty, obviously I spoke to Kelly before Christmas and before she's going home to Australia, and then I just touched base with her the other day to let her know it would be in this week's podcast.
Yeah.
And she worried that it sounded like she worried that she sounded a bit down on Singapore. And I said, no, I don't think so, because on reflection, I think it's a common thing, or it's something that you find with people when they have that sort of annual trip or a trip somewhere that you build up to it.
Yep.
So I think it was good to still keep it in and let, you know, and have that perspective, because I think people think, oh yeah, that's how I feel too.
Now, had she been to the festival that she was looking forward to, the piercing, when you spoke to her last time, or was that still yet to come?
No.
She hadn't, but I saw it on Instagram, so I know she went.
Oh, my God. I'm so glad she said, look, it's not gruesome or macabre or whatever, because, yes, Kelly, it does sound macabre watching people pierce each other or themselves in a group setting. But what a good highlight. I mean, that's why she's written the book too, obviously, is because she's well aware of what's going on in Singapore. But that is not a festival that you would expect to hear about in Singapore either. You know, Singapore always gets such a bad rap for being boring or, you know, the most, the most vanilla of Asian countries and blah, blah, blah. And it's not at all.
No, it's got a lot. So I'm glad we spoke to her and I'm glad that she had those things to say, because I think
I just was going to say the series that she's talking about called Cry that has Asha Keddie in it, etc. I have seen that is being promoted at the moment on the ABC. So she's very lucky that she's been able to see it on the BBC, because it doesn't air in Australia until February. So she's a step ahead of the game. Yeah.
Wow. If you had a VPN.
But I have seen that the ABC are saying, you know, what's on this year, and that keeps coming up. Okay, Nikki, I know I've spoken about just moving on to our, you know, what we're reading, watching, listening to, etc. I know I've spoken about reading Becoming by Michelle Obama, and you had spoken about you'd listen to it via audiobook.
Yep.
And so I'll be very quick because I don't want to go on and on, but we did do it for our book group last month and had our meeting. And one of the things that came up that I thought you and I didn't discuss was, you know, everyone agreed, amazing book, amazing woman, just a really, all of us would recommend it to others. It was one of those books that we didn't have one person in the book group that said, yeah, didn't think it was that good. But one of the things that someone in my book group raised was, you know, how Obama was kind of very much like an expat kid, because we were talking about, if you read Becoming with Michelle Obama, you sort of see that, you know, the whole thing, sorry, that one of the things of him was that how everywhere they stayed, he had the reading room. Can you remember that? He had to have, they called it the hole.
Yes.
Yep. You know, that he had to, he called it the hole, where a space where he could go in and just read and close the door. And this is pre being the president. This is just, you know, living with Obama, that he had to have his space and that he was very much doing his own thing. And I was saying, you know, that in some ways it came across almost slightly kind of selfish, that he was very much, this is what I do, this is how I do it. While he, which seems like such a weird word to explain him as, saying selfish, because he was such a giver and such a community person, or he is so community driven. But it was raised in our book group of, did he just have a little bit of expat kid about him, in that people come and people go and that you're moving along all the time? Because, of course, he was the kid that moved to a different country and then, you know, he moved back to another place to be with his grandparents. Like, there was a lot of shuffling around. I just thought it was a way that I hadn't really thought about Barack Obama before, and that, you know, something for the podcast.
Yeah. So, yeah, he was an expat kid. I mean, if you've read his earlier books, Dreams from My Father, etc., that he wrote before he was a senator, when he was the editor of the Harvard Law Review, he talks about his time in Indonesia with his mother and his sister and everything. Mm. So, I think that is a good point. I didn't really think about it as selfish. I just thought about it, which is a good point. I just thought about it as the point of view of, in order to get through all the reading that he wanted to do, he had to have a place to do it. And so, and in order to have the ideas and participate and be able to comment coherently, he felt that he had to have this immense amount of knowledge in the way he did that.
Yeah, and he is a brilliant person.
Your point is also valid.
But also, Nikki, you know, you think about when he wrote that book, The Dreams of My Father. Can you remember the situation of how he wrote that? That it was after they got married and he took off to Bali? And yes. I just think,
yes, which he doesn't write, which is nothing in his book about that. And I was listening to that and I thought, oh, I know, my gosh.
So,
yeah, no.
So for those who haven't read, and this isn't a great spoiler, but he, you know, they get married
you know, they're in their honeymoon period, and he breaks the news to her that he's missed the deadline for his book and he will be fined $40,000, or, you know, lose the advance that he was given for writing his book. And so his mother has booked him to go and she's found a great little place for him to go and take 6 weeks off and write the book, or 8 weeks off and write the book. Now, I don't know about you, Nikki, but if my husband said to me after we were married, hey, look, I'm sorry to break this to you, but I actually haven't done what I was meant to do, so I could be $40,000 in the hole for this, and but it's okay. Mum's found a great little place for me to go on my own for 8 weeks and, you know, bunker down, and it's in Bali. I just thought, you know.
Yeah, I don't. I think it's a testament to the way, to what the book focused on, that people didn't pull that out and say, are you kidding me? And that wasn't used more broadly in media conversation about the book, because really, for a newlywed couple, that is quite outrageous.
Yes, and it also wasn't, I don't know whether I just missed it, but also I didn't seem to hear a lot said about the fact that she basically said they both smoke pot. And that, you know, she kind of just moving right along. Yeah, he smoked pot, I smoke pot, here we, and I'm going to just keep going. And I didn't hear a lot about that. And I thought, isn't it interesting when you look at how far we've come in a time of Clinton being, you know, the president that didn't inhale. And then here we are now, and we have the ex-president's wife casually mentions pot smoking and moves right along, and it's not spoken about over and over and over and over.
What I think, I think in his book he said he did pot and more, if I remember correctly. So it wasn't just, And there was some discussion about it at the time when he first started being a candidate. Yes. But then, then certain things kicked in.
So tell me about what you're reading, because I'm pretty sure I have on my bookshelf what you're reading at the moment. And I,
right. So what I'm reading is another audiobook read by the author, which I love, and it's Any Ordinary Day by Lee Sales, which I know is a massive book in Australia right now and was a big Christmas gift book, and a lot of people have had it. And it really and we talked before about several podcasts where she was interviewed about the book, and we talked about how the different style of each of the interviewers. So I think if people have been listening to the podcast, they'll have an idea about what the book's about. But it's about the day that turns your life upside down usually starts like any other, but what happens the day after that. So because Lee Sales is a journalist, and she's on an Australian TV show called The 7:30 Report, which is on the ABC, which is the Australian national broadcaster. And every night she interviews people and brings stories to the Australian public that are current events, tragedies, political stories, all sorts of things. But I think that she just felt, by all the people she interviewed them often in a very difficult time of their life. Mm. And then she and the country move on. And she was just thinking about what happens after that. How do all the tragedies and the things that happen, how do they impact you moving forward over time? And so she researched that and wrote the book. And I tell you, it is, I loved the podcast about it, so I knew I had to read it / listen. And I just, honestly, it's fantastic. I really, really enjoy it. And the people that she interviews is like a little bit of Australian history in the last sort of 20 to 30 years as well. And that sort of takes you down all those pathways. Like she interviews Stuart Diver, who, for people that aren't Australian, would probably never have heard of Stuart Diver, but there was a landslide in an Australian ski resort. Yes, we do have ski resorts in Australia, not many, but a few. And he and his wife were trapped under an apartment building, and they were trapped there together, but unfortunately she didn't survive and he did survive. And at the beginning of the landslide, and then when they were first trapped, they were both alive, and then by the time they got out, only he was alive. And then he went on to find, and that was obviously a terrible tragedy. He went on to find love and remarry, and then his second wife died from breast cancer. And so she talks to him about how is that possible? You know, how do you have two marriages and two relationships that go through that? And then because she's quite a practical person and a thinking person, she goes to see a statistician, and she says, what are the odds of this happening? And then what are the odds of him being having another relationship and it happening again. And apparently, just for interest's sake, in the third relationship, it's more likely that something happens to Stuart than it happens to his wife.
I know.
Just things like that, just the way, the path that takes you down. She spoke with one of the hostages taken during the Lint Cafe siege. She spoke with Walter Mikak, whose wife and children were killed at Port Arthur, which was Australia's biggest gun massacre. And just, but then spoke with also some other people that you just sort of, I mean, these names are instantly recognisable to you, some of them, and then some of them are not so instantly recognisable, but she delves into the story and you think, oh, yes, I heard about that, I read about that, et cetera. And they're just really ordinary people getting on with their lives, and it's the way that she interviews them, the way that she deals with them, the way that she's very honest with her emotions as well. She talks about mistakes that she feels that she's made in her journalistic life. Because these people are being interviewed in public on their very worst days.
And what
days.
Does she say about
she
that?
She talks
what
about.
What does she?
Okay, so she was also an expat in that she lived in the US and reported over there for the ABC, I think, also. And she was in New Orleans after the hurricane there. And she said that she found a woman and was interviewing her who was obviously in very bad shape and very had lost a lot of things and was very upset. But she was excellent talent. So she kept speaking to her and kept asking her the next question when in the back of her mind she was thinking, I should stop because this woman is too distressed. I should stop this interview. And she said there was a 10-year-old kid there who said, that's enough. And after she asked another question and the kid said again, that's enough. She said it's horrifying to her that she thinks back and a 10-year-old child could recognize the situation that she was basically, I don't think she used the word exploiting, but she was definitely the situation was something that she was using to her advantage. And there was no advantage in this woman talking to her. For the woman, there was advantage for Lee in her interview, but not for the woman talking to her. And she just talks about how she thinks that she's, you know, a fair person and a good journalist and examines every situation from a lot of viewpoints, but she still reflects that she has made mistakes in her life and perhaps that haven't been great for people that are in that situation. So I think that's also a really fascinating part of the book. The just the sort of self-reflection, as we talked about reflection, but you know the self-reflection on that part of her life as well. So highly recommend.
Oh, fantastic! Because I actually have two copies because I was given it twice.
Oh,
so no, that sounds fantastic. Okay, I watched a couple of movies in recent plane trips. One was 55 Steps, which was just really quite harrowing. It's a true story. Hilary Swank plays a patient's rights lawyer for the real life person is Eleanor Reese, but it was played by Helena Bonham Carter. And it's the story of a woman who's in a psychiatric ward who's been given treatment and doesn't want it and calls her patient's rights lawyer to say, I don't want this treatment. And it's the court case that follows that. And it is harrowing in that you watch the treatment and know that she knows what's going on. Character herself, you can tell, has needed some assistance by her mother when she's been raised in an intellectual capacity. But she is definitely sort of smart enough to live independently and look after herself. But the treatment that she has been given has caused her all sorts of grief, you know, whether it's with her bladder or her heart or, you know, just terrible. And so you watch it and it is really harrowing to see her go under that sort of treatment and have absolutely no voice at all to sort of look after herself. Anyway, it's a true story. It's a great story. It's one of those things where you see both of the people in real life at the end of the movie.
Oh.
And yeah, so I'd definitely recommend it. 55 Steps, it's called. And the other one I watched is called Life Itself. And it's made by the same people who made This Is Us, the television series. And that is exactly what it feels like. It is this
epic sort of story. But it does very much feel like you're watching kind of the telly movie of This Is Us. Not as big a family. It runs across a few generations. And it's one of those ones where you're trying to work out, well, how is that person going to tie in with that person? And you're thinking all the way through it, well, no, well, maybe they're going to be this, or maybe they're going to end up being that, or how will that come back to that? So yeah. It's good. And it's got a very Southern American feel to it, as in South American, not deep South, you know what I mean? South yes. American feel to it. So, yeah, and I have heard really mixed reviews, and I've read crappy reviews from reviewers, but then I've heard of friends who've watched it and loved it. So I'll leave it up to you. What have you been watching, Nikki?
Well, I have been watching on Netflix Sex Education, which yes. I loved. Now, this week there's been the announcement that Gillian Anderson will be playing Margaret Thatcher in the next series of The Crown, not the one that's about to come out, but the one after. And if I had heard that before I had seen this, I would have thought, that is so weird. That is a weird choice. But to see her play in this, she's playing an English sex therapist mother living with her teen son who has sexually related hang-ups.
Now, is this something that you would watch with your teen son?
No, I don't think you can watch it together. I watched a little bit of it with him. He just climbed into bed with me and we had like 10 minutes. He said, "Mom, what are you watching? This is not appropriate for you." And so, but it's so hard to describe how it would be to watch, because I really enjoyed it. I just watched it by myself. I giggled and whatever. But it's the mother who's way too involved because she's a sex therapist. She wants to talk to her son about all sorts of things. And then the son who has the hang-ups. And then he becomes a sex therapist for his school friends, for his peers at school. But so he can't do any of the things he's talking about. But because he lives and breathes in this house where his mother is constantly, you know, conducting therapy sessions, he understands what all the issues are and the problems, and when he doesn't, he researches it, and it's about sort of his journey to be able to overcome his own hang-ups as well. It is fantastic. It's set in the UK in a sort of town, not a big city, more a country vibe, but not really rural. And it's just, look, I highly recommend it, but I wouldn't watch it with your teen, but it's maybe something your teen would enjoy. What about listening, Kirsty? What are you listening to?
Listening, I listen to something called The Fitzroy Diaries, which has been the best thing I have listened to in a long time. It was on Radio National. I can't remember now whether it was about a 6-part or an 8-part. So my aunt is a big ABC listener, as in Australian radio, and she shared it saying, oh, the best thing about the summer has been revisiting all of the old ABC, you know, haunts have come back this year. So it was something that she must have listened to live on the radio, and then they've, you know, put it together as a podcast. But the premise is mother with baby in a sling on her chest goes out for a walk in Fitzroy, which is a suburb in Melbourne, each night, and it's about the people that she sees on a regular basis and that feeling of community. It's not a doco. It is actually a piece of art in that it's obviously been scripted and they use actors for the voices, but she is a beautiful storyteller. It's the most simple of simple podcast ideas, and it was just beautiful to listen to. I think I am a big lover of communities and the power of a community, and so it probably really appealed to me because that's my thing. I'm a big believer of forming communities and the importance that they have in people's mental health and, you know, looking after each other, and that it takes a wide array of people to make that village. And this really sums all of that up. You get a little piece of everybody there, and it's just beautifully done. So it's called The Fitzroy Diaries.
Yeah, I have listened to it Yeah, I listened to the first couple of episodes, I think, and I didn't finish, so I might go back and do that. I think that was a while
ago. I just found it really soothing. I was you know, out walking at night, and I just found it really, like, very soothing. Yeah. Anyway, sorry. You.
Yes. So a lot of my faves were on a Christmas hiatus, so I had the opportunity to listen to some new-to-me pods. One of the ones I listened to was The High-Low, which loads of people had talked about it as a recommendation. It's two English journalists, I think, Dolly and Pandora.
Yep. Heard of this one too.
And they do a weekly pop culture news podcast. I think the episode I listened to wasn't the best one because it was a sort of an in-joke one. It was a Christmas review, and they sort of had a pop quiz about each other, and it wasn't the best one to listen to, but I am going to listen to another one because I think I will enjoy it. The other thing was I listened to a few true crime ones. I know they're not always your favorite, but what I did listen to, which was done by BBC Radio Scotland, which was six episodes plus an update, was The Doorstop Murder. And I think the thing is that drew me to it was you don't always hear a Scottish accent in podcasts. Just hearing the Scottish accent, I quite enjoy a Scottish accent. It's very soft.
Yeah, I agree.
So it was just a podcast about a guy whose name I forget, but I'll put it in the show notes, who opened his door one morning and the guy on the doorstep shot him.
God.
And they've never been able to solve the murder. Oh. He was a local bank manager, and so they've gone down all these paths and information. But the wife, who was at home at the time with their two children, had never spoken before. So this is sort of the journalist gets to go and speak to the wife about it, and also while re-examining the case. So it's just one of those true crime podcasts. It's got sort of it's a limited series, etc. I just enjoyed it because it was a story I had heard of but I wasn't really familiar with, and then I just enjoyed the action as well. So it's just enjoy listening to something a bit different. That's what I'd say.
Great. All right, Nikki, just a reminder, any money questions for Mr. X, please head over to twofatexpats.com, click on the microphone and leave your question, and he'll be back next week to answer it. Of course, we love all your ratings and reviews. So if you happen to be on iTunes or whichever app or podcast app that you use, please give us a like or a rating, because it helps us get our message out to everyone else. Feel free to share us with your friends.
Okay, and I'll speak to you again. Now we're back on schedule. I'll speak to you again, I think, next week. You'll still be in Oz. Is that right?
Yes, I'm here for the next few weeks because my children start, the two middle ones go back to, they start the school year in Australia, and my eldest one will start university in about a month. So my next few weeks.
Oh, so exciting.
Yeah. So my next few weeks are getting child number two and three back to school and making sure that number three is completely settled and made some friends and happy with, is all stocked and everything he needs before I go back. Child number one will be moving into a unit and she will start university, and she is busy working her little tail off at the moment. She's been working every day of the summer, which is great to see for any of you out there that are concerned that your expat children have been pampered and, you know, will never be able to serve fish and chips and work in a greasy kiosk. Trust me, they'll get through. They will. And so, yeah, I'm here for a while, but what it has meant, and maybe we can discuss this next week when we're talking about being geographically challenged or our expat relationships, is we are having a very tough time as a family at the moment. I think we all underestimated what it would mean to have three here and one there. The balance is very much off kilter at the moment. We have a very sad boy back in Qatar, and, you know, it has been tough. It has been very tough, but we can talk about that next week.
Yes. So bumper episode this week to start off the new year. So
yes.
If you got to the end, congratulations.
Okay.
Speak to you next week.
All right. See you next week.
Bye.
Bye.
Bye.